Hey, glad you can make it. And welcome to the Employee Cycle Podcast, where we talk to HR innovators, thought leaders, and even some disruptors about the latest in HR trends, HR tech, and you guessed it, HR data. Well, you've heard enough of me talking. Now let's start the show.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Employee Cycle Podcast. You know me, I'm your host, Bruce Marable, CEO of the HR analytics company, Employee Cycle. And you know us, we help all you HR leaders out there who are building crappy, messy, manual spreadsheet dashboards by pulling all your data together from all your different systems. Well, you don't have to do that anymore because we've automated that entire process with pre-built connectors to all your different HR systems to be able to bring all that data into one beautiful, real-time, centralized HR dashboard. But that's enough about us, because today I have an awesome guest. We are going to talk about, you know, failure. I think this is a really interesting topic, especially now that we have a lot more people moving into the startup space and moving into this space where people are saying fail fast or failure is just the first thing you need to get through before you actually succeed. But without further ado, please help me welcome to the podcast, Chris Dyer, CEO of People G2. And I'm proud to say this is the first time on our podcast I can say best-selling author of The Power of Company Culture. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much. So today our topic is how to build a culture that's not afraid to fail. But before we do that, our first question on our podcast interviews are always, how did you end up in the wonderful world of HR?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it just sort of like landed there. Took a job at another background check company long, many, many years ago, just because it was a good opportunity. And, you know, I ended up just sort of in the business. And then we began sort of working in other areas inside of HR. And so I love people. I love talking about how do we motivate people? How do we work with people? And what are leaders and really talented people doing to be successful? It's always something that's fascinated me.
Nice. And then you are CEO of People G2. What does People G2 do?
So our primary focus is we are a background check and employment screening firm. That's my day job. I mean, I'm a speaker, an author. I do lots of training and consulting around, you know, culture, engagement, teams, remote organizations as well. But my primary focus is that background check, you know, and employment screening.
Got it. And then you recently wrote the book, The Power of Company Culture. Could you give our audience a quick summary of what the book is about so they know whether this is something that they should go buy?
Yeah, so the book is broken down into three pieces. The first section is, what do you got to do to not suck, right? Like, what's the basic stuff inside of culture? And a lot of companies think they've got that right and they don't. And so what's the baseline? And then the second part of the book are, what are the things that I discovered through my research that we experiment with in my company and through my hundreds of interviews and my podcast? What were those things that the best companies were consistently talking about over and over and over again? And I call that my seven pillars. And so that's in the book. We break it down, what it is, how to do it. And then the third part, which is, maybe you find something that you agree with. Maybe you find something in my book that you're like, you know what? Chris is right. We really should do better at this thing. And how do you get people to change? How do you get them to think about doing things differently or better? You know, what does that look like? And so we really focus on that cognitive biases, change management, and really try to give very practical tips on things that people can do to really help their organizations get better.
Nice. So our topic today is how to build a culture that's not afraid to fail. But the first thing we really need to talk about is, what is failure? A lot of people define it a lot of different ways. Some people look at it as experience. Other people look at it as heart-crushing and that the world is over. So how do you define failure for us to be able to really talk about this topic?
Well, inside of this topic, so one of my pillars is mistakes, right? So the best organizations know how to deal with mistakes. And that's the kind of the same thing as what you're talking about here with failure. And I make a very big distinction between mistakes and errors. So errors are those things that people do wrong that they shouldn't have done wrong, right? They miscalculate payroll. They don't know how to use a calculator, right? They're mistrained. They're the wrong person in the job. You know, they're over their head. They're going too fast. They're being sloppy. They're, you know, trying to multitask, which is not a real thing. Science has proven we cannot multitask. You know, trying to do all that stuff, right? That's an error, and those things should not be tolerated inside of organizations. But mistakes, right, and the failure component is when we're trying to do something great, we're trying to do something better. We thought we had all the right information. We thought we had the right details, and then we failed, right? And it wasn't because we did anything wrong. It was because we were trying something great. We were trying to do something right. A fantastic example of this is Southwest Airlines. They will back any employee. Okay, you will never see Southwest Airlines bash an employee or say they did something wrong in the news. They will always support them if the employee believed they were doing the right thing for the customer. So they will always back them up. Now, privately, they may review that and say, you know what, you shouldn't have done this, and let's retrain you, and let's explain to you why. But they will always back their employees if they believe they were trying to do the right thing for the customer. And that's that same thing, right? So it gives them that freedom to try new things, to be, you know, if you've ever been on a Southwest Airlines flight, there's a different vibe. There's a different feel. They have a certain freedom. They have a certain, you know, autonomy inside of that airplane. And that comes from that freedom that they give them to be themselves.
Got it. So when we were talking about the topic that you were going to discuss, we came down to building a culture that's not afraid to fail. I'm assuming that you feel strongly that most companies are afraid to fail, or they build a culture where people are afraid to fail. Why is that important?
Yeah. So one of the things that companies do that is a big problem is they will design their initiatives or their offerings or whatever they're going to do around one specific large offering or event. And then when they fail, it's catastrophic and all the pressure is on there. Instead of looking at their experience in the marketplace as a continual set of experiments and attempts and kind of working through what works. It's almost like, you know, A-B testing in marketing. Right. We if you go out and spend all your money on one ad and then it doesn't work, you've wasted all that money and you have failed, right? And people will get mad at you and you might lose your job. Why in the world would anyone do that? Why wouldn't you start with 10 ads, right? Or 20 ads and spend a bit of money and figure out which ones do well? And then and so if you find one that does really great and the other 9 did bad, you technically failed 9 times, but you found the one that worked really well, and then you can spend a whole bunch of your money on that. Right, so a culture that thinks about how do we look at lots of different possibilities and be open to many different ways of doing things and experiment and think about it that way to find the best way to do it. That's a culture that thinks that is okay with failure. That's a culture that's okay with trying new things because they know and they're totally okay with most of the time it totally sucking and failing if the ultimate goal is to find the right thing that does work.
Interesting. The gray area seems to be where you want to give a lot of your employees autonomy to be able to make decisions and have power and authority. But on the same token, there are certain things that you have to get right in order for the company to move forward or to stay alive. So for a company that's trying to create this environment of making sure that people aren't afraid to fail because they don't want to stifle innovation or make people feel like they can't bring fresh, original ideas to the table, how do you balance both sides of that?
Well, you know, when something is mission critical, you can expect that more people are going to be involved or more senior people are going to be involved, right? So this is not about the CEO just calling up, you know, your brand new employee and saying, you know, come up with a great new advertising campaign for us. I mean, you know, and saying that that's autonomy. That's not how it works, right? Autonomy is you give everyone the square or the circle that they live in, right? What is your job description? What do we want you to do? And then we give you the autonomy to do your job inside of those parameters. And so if something big comes down the line, maybe we're looking at it, are we going to go to a brand new CRM? Are we going to change the way we operate? You can expect a lot of people to be involved in that process. And so autonomy doesn't mean we just give it to one person and leave them alone. It means that we ask people to figure those things out and to give them their part of the team and to come together and work to figure out what's the best thing. And really, failure, again, is about experimentation. It's about trying different things. We shouldn't buy one CRM. Maybe we should get a demo of 6. Maybe we should get a sandbox in those. We should play in those. Maybe we should invite a sales team and the customer service team and get their feedback and thoughts and play around with all of that before we make a big decision. And that means involving a lot of people. It means teaming a lot, right? So autonomy is not always about just sending somebody off into a corner, into a back office and telling them to figure out and don't come out until you do.
Got it. So one of the reasons why our audience loves to listen to our podcast is because we try to make it as practical as possible. So for the HR listeners that are out there hearing you talk about this, let's break this into three different sections. The first being, how do I identify if my existing culture is afraid to fail? If so, how do I change it so that failure and the ability to fail is a part of our culture so that we don't become risk averse and stifle innovation? And then how do I prove the ROI in the back end, or at least test to make sure that this was worth it, but that also it's moving the ball forward? How does that sound?
Right. So I'll bet you that most of your listeners who are in HR know right away whether or not they have that kind of culture or not, because it comes from the top. Your senior leaders, your CEO, they are determining that culture. If they fire people, rip, you know, people apart, yell and scream with somebody, if things don't go right, you know, instead of using it as a way to learn and innovate to go forward, you know which kind of culture you're in, and it's set. And there are things that I can give you some practical tips that HR can use to begin to introduce that into a culture. But ultimately, whether or not your organization really lives by that, it comes from your senior leaders, because they have to show, they have to demonstrate to everybody else that it's okay for us to fail. It's okay for us to think about this, our projects and our decisions as possibilities, and we need to experiment and think about which one is really going to be the best. Now, inside of that, Google actually has a lot of really good data around this, and they came up with what makes a great team. And they went back and studied this and thought, you know, was it 3 introverts, 2 extroverts, you know, 5 engineers, 2 customer service people, you know, 2 men, 2 women? I mean, what was the combination, right, that would make a fantastic team? Because some of their teams did fantastic and some of their teams did not, and they wanted to know why. And ultimately what they discovered, and I have found that implementing this really, really helps create the environment inside of a team to at least be willing to deal with mistakes and failure. And that is, they have to deal with 3 things. The first is, you have to, as a group, decide, what does success look like, right? Clearly define what is our group trying to do. What is our goal? What is our purpose? Why are we here? And you'd be shocked how many times teams come together. You create a team to go find a new CRM, and they never talk about what success is. They never say, well, the sales team should love this system. The customer service team should love this system. It should be affordable for us, right? It shouldn't be, you know, too expensive. Whatever those things are that makes it successful. The second thing is, they have to decide what failure looks like. What would happen if they failed, right? Talk about what are the things that they would do. Maybe they didn't communicate properly. Maybe they didn't get enough options. Maybe they didn't get the CEO's buy-in, right? What are the things that would cause them to fail? And get them up front talking about this stuff. Because then you can begin to kind of, you know, circumvent some of those things that we're talking about on the failure side. And third and most important is, that group has to decide how they will deal with conflict, right? And it's different from group to group. One group might say, majority rules, we're just going to take a democratic vote, and whatever the majority is, that's the way we're going to go. Or they might say, we're going to get together and talk about it, but the team leader, they're going to decide ultimately what we're going to do. Other groups might say, we're going to bring in an outside manager who isn't in our group to help us be the tiebreaker. Whatever that resolution is, they need to decide up front how they're going to deal with conflict, because that's a reason that we avoid taking chances and being innovative, is we don't want to get in trouble, right? We don't know what's going to happen if we fail. We don't know what's going to happen if we make a mistake. Are we going to lose our job, or are we just going to have, you know, a conversation about it and regroup and go try something new? So I know that's a really long answer, but that's really where HR people can start.
Interesting. So when it comes to allowing people to see it from the top, allowing employees to see that the CEO, CFO, whoever they're looking up to, or it could even be their direct boss, showing them that it's okay to fail, how deeply ingrained does that need to be into the company, and how visible does it need to be? Does it need to be on the walls, in our handbook? Does it need to be in the company values on the website? How much does this, let's just call it embracing of failure, needs to be explicit versus just known based off of the culture and how people act?
I can tell you what I do inside my company, and that is we have a few things. First of all of my managers we talk about and are coached on a regular basis to constantly bring up to their team their failures, their mistakes, what they did wrong, and how they went about correcting it. So to show up to a meeting and say, you know what, guys, we tried this thing. I thought it was going to work. It didn't. So we're going to do this instead, right? To be open and honest and transparent about what didn't go right for us, right? The second thing is we have a room in our Slack program. It's called Oops, My Bad, where everybody goes and admits the things that they, you know, didn't get right. And they bring them up in a public forum so that we can share them with everyone in the company and give them the opportunity to learn from our mistakes. Learn from what we did wrong. Maybe it might spark, you know, some other innovation. Like we realized that some of us were making some dumb mistakes inside Slack. And so someone took it upon themselves to make a bunch of help videos that now we introduce to every one of our employees when they start with us. They have a set of videos to train them, you know, common things that we get wrong in this system, right? So we kind of sparked some innovation for us there. And the third thing that we do is every month I have an all company meeting, and in that meeting I have a little CEO message. You know, I have 5 minutes that I present things that are on my mind, things I want them to think about, but I always make sure I let them know what stupid thing I did this month, right? So we're constantly reinforcing that we're human beings, we make mistakes, and what's important is that we're open and honest and we're sharing and that we correct the error. Right. And we figure out how to get it right in the end. It's not about being perfect. It's about getting it right eventually.
So you talked about not only your team, but you standing in front of your team, talking about some of the stupid mistakes you made, which I think is awesome. And I'm going to have to implement and steal that from you as well. But how do you know the difference between an employee making a mistake or failing one time versus failing consistently? And how do you draw that line of, well, they failed here, but that wasn't that bad, or they failed enough where we need to let them go.
Right. So again, you have to be very clear about, is this a mistake or is this an error? And so we have to look at the job. I think someone in who's programming, I think someone who's in marketing, they spend most of their job failing, right? They try it and then they see if it works and then they correct it. And so in those contexts, that's what we expect from them. If someone in sales who's consistently doing the wrong thing, and then they're not able to learn and get better from it, right? They're not ultimately meeting the goals that you've set from them. I think that's where we need to look. So if we use sales as an example, and you have a quota for them, and over a period of time, they're just not getting there, despite that maybe they're learning and they're making mistakes, but then they get better. But if they haven't met the goals that you expect from this person, then that's what you need to ultimately use to decide whether or not, you know, to keep them. So there has to be more to it than just whether or not they made a mistake. It really shouldn't be about that. It's ultimately about, did they reach those goals that you've set for them? And being fair to them about, did they have the resources? Did they have the opportunity and all of that? So it's sort of a multi-pronged thing. The biggest challenge we have, again, is trying to determine if it's an error or not. You know, we recently had an employee make, you know, $1,000 mistake. We thought $1,000 error. And it took us 3 days of investigation to figure out, did the person make an error, right? Should they have known better? And ultimately what we found out was the client had given them so much bad information that they were doing the best thing they thought they should have. And based on what the information they had, and ultimately this was a mistake and they learned from it and they know what to look for next time, but it wasn't their fault. Our client told them, I mean, absolutely the wrong thing over and over and over again, and provided them so much bad data. I couldn't possibly have expected that employee to have made a better decision than the one they made. Next time they'll be aware and they won't make that. But there was no punishment. There was no writing them up. There was no, you know, anyone getting mad at them, even though it cost us a bunch of money, because it really wasn't their fault. It was they were making the best decision they could. So sometimes it takes a bit of time, and I'm sure your listeners or HR people are understand this, right? You need to get all the facts, all the information, talk to everyone, and then figure out, what is this something that is a personality problem and problematic, or was this just a bad situation and we all can learn from it?
So to set realistic expectations for the listeners out there, when HR leaders are trying to build a culture of accepting, let's call it smart failure, intelligent failure, and they're trying to build this culture where everyone feels empowered to be able to do things that they believe might not work, But if it does, it's going to bring value to the company. We all know that it's almost impossible to make everybody have that mindset, especially when you get people who may be super type A, need everything perfect, the type of person that needs their inbox zero. They can't have any unopened emails or more than a certain amount of tabs on their browser. Desk always has to be spotless. How do you get those type of people to also adopt to that? Or should you have not hired them in the first place? Or what do you do with that?
I guess it depends on the person and the position, right? So that kind of person in one job would be a nightmare for me. And I'd be like, there's no way they're ever going to kind of make it. And in a different job, maybe that's the right thing. You know, my quality assurance people are very detail oriented. They have high responsibility. I expect them to catch errors and to watch, and their job is to get it right for the client. They're not in a position to be out there trying and experimenting things, right? But they can make mistakes, and we have to figure that out. So sometimes mistakes happen because we just didn't have the right information, we didn't have the right data, and we need to learn from that. Sometimes mistakes come from innovation, right? Where we are intentionally trying new things. So that type of person that you mentioned may not be in a position to be trying new things. And so that's a much different position and a different thing. But as an organization, it just depends on what you're doing. So if you're a law firm, this is a totally different way to interpret it than if you are trying to build, you know, a competitive browser to Google, right? So totally different implementations of what that word means and how that culture is going to interpret mistakes and failures. So it has to be digested by the leaders, by the organization, and figure out what that means. But ultimately, think about if the employee is trying to do the right thing and is trying to make things better, we need to think about how can we reward them for that and continue to work and coach them in a way to help them be innovative for us going forward.
Do you believe in what Facebook famously coined as fail fast and break things?
I'm not sure if it was Facebook that coined fail fast. It might have been Peter Drucker or someone before them, but they certainly have used that motto. Now they're essentially a software company, right? I mean, their job is to innovate, to try things out, and to quickly make changes based on data and analytics that they're getting on what their, you know, millions of users are using. So in that context, absolutely. When it comes to hiring and firing, I think failing fast is you have to do it, right? You if it doesn't feel like the right person, you gotta make that, you know, quick 90-degree turn, and you gotta if this person's not gonna be the right one, you gotta let it go before it festers. There are other situations where it's less clear. We all get in those situations where it's a 50-50, we're not sure. And I think in those situations, I choose to coach. I choose to really be open and honest and try to give it a set period of time and to go in there and figure out how we can best help people. We had a person one time that just wasn't meeting our expectations. And so we could have fired this person. But instead, the first thing we did is went back and said, talk to us about your job. Tell us what you're doing. Can you give us the full picture of how you work, where you work, when you work, all of this, right? We went back and started from basics and discovered that this person was missing a piece of equipment we thought they had, that everybody else had. And once we got them that piece of equipment, they started outperforming everybody else, right? And so we had to go back and re-examine that person and be open and fair with them and to figure out why it wasn't working. It's not always the person. Sometimes it's the scenario, the situation, or the equipment or the information. So you really have to be open to all those possibilities. But once you make a decision, I do agree, you need to move quickly.
Got it. And then last question for this section. Do you think we're currently over-glorifying failure, especially in the startup space?
I think there's a lot of talk about it. There's a lot of people out there saying that they, you know, they're okay with failure and fail fast, and they're okay with mistakes. And there are very few companies that really walk the walk. I mean, 3M is one that's been doing it since, like, I don't know, the 60s, you know, where they document every mistake they make, everything they do. And, you know, that's why Post-its exist. Somebody many, many years ago made a really crappy glue, but they documented it and they kept it in a database. And one day another scientist said, I wonder if anyone else has ever made a really crappy glue. And behold, that's how we have a Post-it. You know, so do you really have a culture of innovation? Do you really deal with mistakes and document them and use them as ways to grow and build, you know, or do you say that, but then when it happens, are you yelling and screaming and firing people? And I find most people are the latter, unfortunately. Being okay with mistakes, being okay with failure, being willing to do that, it's really hard to do. It's really messy. And, you know, if you're not making money, if you're not cutting it, if things are tough, I mean, it's really easy to start blaming and pointing fingers and all that. So I think there's a lot of lip service out there when it, you know, as it relates to this topic.
So now we're going to move into my favorite part of the podcast, which we call the real, the random, and the ridiculous. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. The real question, do you like to eat bread pudding? And if so, how do you like it made?
Do I like to eat bread pudding? I wouldn't turn it down, but I wouldn't order it either. So I guess, you know, I'm kind of in the middle.
Chris. I have to make you a
burger. All right.
All right. The random question, what do you think is your biggest failure to date?
My biggest failure to date. You know, I've tried a few times to do different things inside our organization. We tried a couple different iterations and different experimentations. You know, one of the things I did early on when I moved my company remote is I thought that we were going to have this great, like, newsletter that was going to come out every week or every month, and everyone was going to contribute to it, and we were going to keep everyone updated on what everyone was doing, right? I thought I was going to be the center of this, right? And I couldn't keep up with it, and I couldn't get people to contribute to it. And I think back then my failure was I thought that I had to be the driver of the things that I valued in my organization. And what I discovered was I needed to find other people who had a passion for the things that we valued and let them put their own stamp on it, their own unique component to it, and let them run with it. And when I did that, we were so much more successful. The more I get the heck out of the way of my people and just set the tone, talk about what's important, but let them run with it, the better off we are. And the more I get, you know, kind of in the way, and the more I become the kind of the block in the dam, essentially, you know, in the river, if I become the dam there, if I get in people's way, the worse we do.
Wow, that was awesome. And the ridiculous question, what do you think is the most ridiculous reason why most companies don't embrace failure or want to create a culture that's not afraid to fail?
You know, it's probably I don't know how ridiculous this is, but I mean, the real reason is most people just don't know what they don't know, right? You're raised your whole life a certain way. Your parents treat you one way, your teachers treat you another way, you know, your coaches, if you're in sports. And often it's get it right, right? You know, repetition, keep doing the same thing and get it right, get it perfect. Very often, most teachers, most schools don't, and parents don't teach this sort of, it's about the process. It's about how to learn and how to get it right. And that's what we need. And so I think so often it's just, they don't know that there's a better way to do it. They don't know that you can make these changes in how you deal with people that will radically change how your organization works. And so there are a few out there that clearly do it, and their companies are these giant juggernauts, right? And they do fantastic. But most people sort of revert back to how their parents dealt with them on failure. And so I don't know if you need to go sit on a shrink's couch for a year or whatever you got to do to get yourself unstuck from that crap. It doesn't work, right? There's such a better way to deal with failure, deal with mistakes, and to help your organizations be better by eliminating all that stuff that's from when you were a kid.
That was an awesome answer and a great way to end the podcast. Chris, thanks so much for being on the Employee Cycle Podcast.
Thank you, Rick.
Chris, thank you. So where can people find you and your company and your book and all the things online?
Well, if you know where to buy a book, you can probably find The Power of Company Culture there. Amazon.com is a great place. If you're international, bol.com is another one, B-O-L. If you want to find more about me, my website is Chris, the letter P, like Patrick, Dyer, D-Y-E-R. So chrispdyer.com. And if you're interested in People G2, go to peopleg2.com and find out more about background checks and drug testing and whatever else you need. So I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Twitter, I'm on all the social. You can find me if you want to.
Great. And we'll be sure to include all that info in the show notes. So all you listeners out there, thanks so much for listening to this episode. And if you enjoyed it as much as I did, which I'm pretty sure you did, then please leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes so that we know that we're continuously providing awesome content. Also, if you're just a drive-by listener just for this one episode and you want more great content like this, then please make sure you subscribe to the Employee Cycle Podcast on whatever podcast player you're listening to. And without further ado, all you HR and people leaders out there, make sure you continue to hire, train, and retain the best workforce possible. Thanks. Later, kids.
This episode of the Employee Cycle Podcast was edited and produced by Lux Podcast Production. Lux is a creative audio suite that helps clients create, market, and measure their show. Visit luxpodcasts.com to learn how a podcast can benefit your organization. That's LUXEpodcasts.com.